Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kimberly Adams today, and it's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, which means we get to answer your questions. If you have a question you'd like us to answer in the future, you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART, or you can email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. All right, the first question is in the form of an email. Dale from Creedmoor, North Carolina, wants to know, does Fox News pay all of the settlement, or do they have insurance?
You taking this one? I think you're taking this.
No, I think you are.
All right, I will take this one. That's fine. Fine, I will take this one.
I mean, if you want me to.
The answer is yes and no. So the settlement, of course, was $787.5 million American dollars in the Dominion Voting Systems case. The answer is that they are not going to pay the full sticker price. We don't know exactly how they're going to pay, but here are some options, right? First of all, they could. They've got the cash. It would be about 20%, give or take, of the $4 billion they have on hand. But number one, as happens in most cases of this nature, where there is a judicial ruling against them, Fox can deduct it. Sorry, it's not a judicial ruling. In most cases like this, where there is a settlement, Fox can deduct it from their taxes, right? It's a business-related expense. So part of that comes off their taxes, number one. If they are insured, which of course they are, because Fox is a big, giant company, an insurance company will pay some part of that. Partner at a media liability insurance firm said anywhere from $100 million to $500 million of that could conceivably be covered, depending on what their challenges are. But here's this thing about Fox. This was one of many, many cases, both from individuals and against individuals and shareholders. And there's another one from another voting machine company that's a $2.7 billion case. So this is not done yet by a long shot for Fox. It's going to cost Rupert Murdoch some money, but it's not going to be the whole $787 out of his pocket. That's the deal. Yeah.
You know, I saw today a story that basically Fox Corporation lost the equivalent of this settlement in its share price after Tucker Carlson announcement.
Right.
Just to put that in perspective.
Yeah. There's Tucker. There it is. Okay. Next question. Another email. Here's what Bill in New Lebanon, New York wants to know. When college loan payments are eventually restarted, will that serve as a disinflationary pressure upon the economy? That's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. So a little reminder, federal student loan payments have been paused for more than 3 years now. It started at the beginning of the pandemic in the Trump administration. The Biden administration has kept extending that pause. But those payments are set to resume later this year. And this is where it gets a little confusing. Either they will start 60 days after June 30th, which is late August by my count, or 60 days after lawsuits blocking Biden's student loan forgiveness plan are resolved in court, depending which happens first. As you know, there's a larger plan to extend up to $20,000 in debt for folks who earn, I believe it's less than $125,000 a year. And that has been held up in court. In terms of the inflation question, when the Biden administration extended the pause last year, critics said that move would make inflation worse by basically putting more money in people's pockets, which adds stimulus to the economy, adds demand, which is, you know, part of what's been pushing up prices. And some economists were concerned about that, others less so. You know, I think there's an ongoing debate about how much helping people afford their debts contributes to inflation. But the idea is that if borrowers don't have to make monthly student loan payments, they have more in their wallets to spend. So when those payments resume, in theory, they will have less money in their wallets. Mm-hmm. But last year, economists at Goldman Sachs estimated the impact of the moratorium would be pretty small on inflation. So on the flip side, resuming payments will probably have a pretty small effect, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Stephanie Hughes did a good piece for us the other day on what happens to companies, right? What it's going to do for retail sales, because as people might remember, retail sales were down last month by like 0.9%. Not great in a consumer driven economy. And so these consumers who now are going to have to re-up on their student loans will, as Amy said, have less money to spend. That will be, you know, marginally good for inflation, but it's going to be marginally bad for companies. So,
yeah,
you know,
that's
put that in your recession pipe and smoke it. Yeah. Okay, that's a technical economic term. Next question, here we go.
I'm wondering if there's an economic story in what my wife and I have referred to as pandemic gray, which is this new battleship gray that almost all of the car companies have universally been painting some of their cars. That sort of battleship, sometimes it's greener, sometimes it's bluer, but I'm curious if you guys know more. Thanks for making me smart. Steve from Philadelphia.
Wow.
Steve. All right, I guess I'll get this one started and maybe we can talk about it.
All right.
I think this is so fascinating because for a long time, if you look around, there are no cars of color other than like beige, white, gray, silver. Super boring, right? But at least they were sparkly. I think what you're referring to, Steve, is these matte grays and blues and greens that don't have the like metallic sparkle in them. And the LA Times wrote a really interesting article about this recent trend with muted earth tones. Apparently, it started with Audi back in 2013 and was popular and led other pricey companies to do the same. Sometimes people pay a premium for these matte colors, which I think is interesting, but it's also trickled down into more affordable cars. And so you're seeing what people call sort of natural tones or even combat, you know, tactical looking colors, which is, I think, pretty interesting. I'm curious, though, about the safety issue. I mean, one of them referred to these colors as stealth. And I have this memory of going to a car lot with my dad when he was shopping for a new car. And he said, close your eyes and then open them and tell me which cars you see. And of course, I saw the yellow car, the red car.
Yeah.
They really stand out, you know. And so you almost never see those colors anymore.
No, and you can go long stretches with only seeing like the whites and the grays, and my theory is that it just goes in trends and streaks, and car companies follow each other. Edmunds, the car people, they say cars painted various shades of white, gray, black, and silver accounted for 75% of new car sales in the United States last year. I totally buy that. Absolutely 100%.
There you go.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, time for our last question of the day, and this one is for Kai.
Hi, I'm Bailey from Austin, Texas. Kai, every day when you do the numbers, you always end it by saying, and bond prices are down and yield on the 10-year T-notes are up, or vice versa, bond prices are up and yield on the 10-year T-notes are down. Does that ever change? Is there ever a case where you've had to say, you know, bond prices are up and somehow interest rates are up?
Oh, good question. The short answer is no, and here's why. So first of all, we have to caveat this by saying the bond market is amazingly complicated. There is about 1,000 different ways you can slice and dice the yield question, right? The interest rate question. You can talk about holding bonds to maturity. You can talk about the coupon yield. You can talk about all different kinds of things. But we'll answer this for the generic bond, the U.S. 10-year. Generally speaking, this is a question of supply and demand. When demand for bonds goes down, right? And let's think about when that might be. If people are feeling good about the American economy, things are great, and they have excess money, where do they put it? They put it in the stock market because that's the opportunity for their money to grow. They do not buy bonds because bonds, government bonds, are the safe haven. They are the place you go if you think that the economy is going to be shaky, things might go downhill, and you are going to need to hang on to your money and have it be safe. And American debt, until the Congress gets done with it, the Republicans in Congress get done with it, American debt is the safest thing on the planet, right? So when demand for bonds goes down, issuers of new bonds, whether it's companies or the government or what have you, they have to offer higher yields, higher interest rates, to make those bonds attractive over the bonds that are already out there, right? And if the value of lower-yielding bonds already on the market goes down, well, then the opposite happens. There you go.
I'm so glad you got that one.
Yeah.
20 years in this business, and the bond market still has a way of twisting my brain around.
Bonds are immensely complicated, and that was a really simple answer to a truly complicated question. But, you know, as I haven't said it much because we haven't talked about bonds much, but if you want to know which way the economy's going, look at bonds, right? They're the flight to safety. They're the flight to safety. They are the thing that people lean on in times of economic stress, which we are arguably entering upon. Keep an eye on bond yields. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. All right, we're done for today. If you've got a question you'd like us to answer, leave us a voicemail, 508-UB-SMART. You can email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can do the voice memo thing as well. We will take it any way we can get it.
Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Berg-Seeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Antonio Barreras. And today's program was engineered by Jessen Duller.
Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the executive director. No, she's not. She's just the regular director of podcasts. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on demand. Oh, my goodness. Sorry, Bridget.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.